Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 650, January 2023.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and oh, wait, no. I'm tearing off my trademark Mission Impossible face mask to reveal that I am, in fact, David J. Lohr. Tonight, we're drafting a dossier of spies, secret agents, and even con artists, because they may come in handy too sometimes. You know, it's hard to tell the difference, because sometimes it takes a thief. Now, to introduce our rogues gallery in the order in which they will draft. Our first guest is a man with a camera, looking nonchalant while photographing the landscape. Or is he photographing a dead drop across the park? It's Tom McGrath.
So are we not doing phrasing anymore?
Oh, good question. Good question. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Our next guest is going to push it, like James Bond in a haystack at a horse farm in Kentucky. File it, like Jaws, sharpening his teeth. Oh dear God, Glenn Weldon was right. I am not doing the whole preamble. It's the co-host of A Degree Absolute, Chris Klimek.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I still have to check the order of the verbs. I tried to correct Glenn this week when he said file was the second one, which it is, and you'd think that after, 50 episodes. No, but I still need to check my script.
And I will thank our last panelist to come through the studded leather door already and leave poor Moneypenny alone. Welcome, Nathan Alderman.
Do you expect me to talk, David?
No, I expect you to draft. So we'll begin our draft. It's a small group, but we've got a lot of things to draft because spies, secret agents, con artists, that's a wide open field. So I think for our first round, we'll start with TV spies and secret agents. It certainly was a trend in the 60s, and it comes and goes, it ebbs and flows. There are some classic ones, and if you pick a TV series that's been turned into a film, that's okay. The films usually are a little different, so I have one thing in particular that I'm thinking, yeah, the films are a separate thing. So let's start with Tom. What's your first pick?
With the first pick, I'm going to go with Archer. I'm glad we stuck with the TV shows.
Ah, very good. Very good.
Because not only does it, the thing that Archer does really well, I think, that's unique to its medium is that it really plays a lot with motif and style too. So it's not just a spy show. It's also a con artist show. They're basically con artists. And then you can go through Miami Vice and like Commando and any of the other sort of Magnum PI genre-y spies and private eyes. It's kind of got something for everybody. And it is filthy, which is also fun.
Yes. Always good. And it's got a killer theme song. That's kind of a good thing for a secret agent.
Yeah, you're going to. I'm hoping that that's going to be thematic to my picks, but we'll see.
Okay.
I think I watched up through the season where they become drug dealers, and it's not that I disliked it or anything. I just, I sort of wandered away, but I'll come back someday. I enjoy a good phrasing as much as the next guy.
So you missed the season where it was all a dream or it was all a coma situation.
Aren't there like three whole seasons of the show where it's a coma?
Gotta be minimum.
I mean, one was like an extended Cannonball Run parody, or not Cannonball Run. What's some other Reynolds, 70s? Oh,
yes. Smokey and the Bandit. There's a whole season that it was.
Yeah, I mean, to carry that gag through how many episodes? Impressive.
There was no horse left to beat.
Degree of difficulty, N plus.
Yeah, it's one of those shows I come back and forth on it. Like I binge a bunch of it, and then I have to walk away for a year or two. But then there's a lot more to binge. It's convenient. Let's move on to our next guest, Chris. What is your first TV pick?
Well, I hate to preempt you, but I think from the hints you were dropping, David, about how sometimes the movies are radically different from the TV show, I'm sorry that I have to steal the Avengers from you. I'm sure.
Well,
98 feature version of the Avengers that I saw in an empty theater.
So did I.
You know, supposedly, I actually Googled Jeremiah Chechik, the Benny and June director who made that film, and I thought it had ended his career, and it turns out it only ended his career as a feature filmmaker. You know, he went to HBO or something and was able to carry on doing meaningful work, you know, from I don't know, correspondence courses in movie jail or something. I love the Avengers, which I came to through Grant Morrison's comic book version in same way I found The Prisoner. Strangely, is that, you know, around the same era, DC Comics published an authorized sequel to The Prisoner back when that show was only 20 years in the past. And Grant Morrison wrote a series called Steed and Mrs. Peel. And I saw an interview with him in Comic Scene or someplace talking about the TV show, which was unfamiliar to me at that time. But I think A&E maybe was rerunning it in the early 90s. And I was just so charmed by this surreal sort of Lewis Carroll kind of fantasy. Invariably our two leads, Patrick McNee's John Steed, and it was the Diana Rigg, Emma Peel era where I came in, and you know, which I still favor, though he had other partners, of course. Invariably described as spies, and that throws me a little bit because they never conceal their identities, or rarely do. You know, they seem never to leave England. They seem to go about their investigations very publicly in this weirdly depopulated post-war England that they inhabit. I wouldn't really describe anything that they do as espionage or tradecraft or spycraft. I mean, they seem to just go up to people and ask questions. They're detectives with better clothes. Yeah,
they really are.
So that's sorry to take it from you. I know that many people come to this through the long running Avengers film series, where Ray Fiennes just seems determined to kill himself doing a wild new stunt every time they have a new one. But
My goodness, yeah. I remember seeing that opening weekend because I grew up on the Avengers in the early 80s, and it hit that mental tickle spot for me. And now here's a strange thing. So yes, it was on A&E in the 90s and into the 2000s, I think. At the time when I found it, it was really hard to find. And then apropos of, it had nothing to do with anything else on the network. It ran on MSG TV in the New York area, Madison Square Garden. So you'd finish a Knicks game, and there was the Avengers at midnight every night. And it made no sense to me. It was the only thing I watched on MSG, but I watched it whenever I could.
That seems like a great midnight show.
Oh, yeah. And just stripping five nights a week. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's terrific. And so, yes, I went to see the film. I was also in an empty theater. I was tempted to leave it completely empty at one point.
As films with Sean Connery speaking recognizably as Sean Connery wearing a giant teddy bear costume go, you could do worse.
The funny thing is, not only did it not kill Jeremiah Chechik's career, he went on to direct, I think, most of the episodes of The Middleman, which was a single season show on ABC Family, which was not the right place for it, but a show based on a comic book series that really catches that Avengers style. It's much more like the Avengers than his Avengers film. Nathan, what is your first TV pick?
Well, I am deeply saddened that the Avengers got sniped. You know, I was going to wax rhapsodic about that moment in every episode when Diana Rigg gets, and I'm going to imagine capital letters here, that look on her face. And I would always sit back on the couch and say, "Aw, son, you done bleeped with Emma Peel." And then she would unleash hell. But instead, I'm going to change from whimsy and surrealism to gritty, bone-dead realism, and the most depressing 1970s fashions, if that's not an oxymoron, that you can imagine. I'm going to go with Neil Burnside, as played by the great Roy Marsden, from a British series called The Sandbaggers, created by a former Royal Navy and intelligence officer named Ian McIntosh, an incredible three-season wonder from British television that ended only because the creator vanished in a small plane over a bay in Alaska and was never heard from again, which is a pretty metal way to go out if you're an ex-spy. But The Sandbaggers is a grim, plotting, very dark show that mostly consists of men in terrible suits having conversations in either sets that look like they were built from cardboard or the most depressing 1970s British McDonald's you can imagine. And it is absolutely riveting. They managed to wring completely nail-biting suspense out of these simple conversations between men in rooms. There's very little action. There's some, but most of it is what's going on back at headquarters. And the show it reminds me the most of, actually, is Andor, which just aired on Disney Plus, which has that same gripping moment-to-moment fascination, the same morally complex characters. And Neil Burnside, he's the head spy. He's one of only two characters that survives throughout the entire series, because boy, does this series have a body count. But he is a mean, nasty, awful SOB, a miserable human being, and just deeply, no one hates Neil Burnside more than Neil Burnside hates Neil Burnside. But he does the hard, unpleasant, and occasionally downright shocking things to keep Britain safe during the Cold War. It was written because McIntosh was tired of these fanciful, larger-than-life spy stories and wanted to show people what it was really like. And if you ever get a chance to see it, I think it is on Tubi, the random streaming service you may or may not have heard of. But if you get a chance, if you like old school, you know, lean to the bone, gritty spy drama, give The Sandbaggers a chance. You will not regret it.
Oh, absolutely. I can second that. I remember discovering that, I think, on WHYY, the PBS station in Philadelphia back in the late 80s, and going, what in God's name is this? This is grim. But yeah, it's really good. I think it was an influence on Greg Rucka's comic series,
yes,
Queen and Country,
yes,
which is similarly grim and intense. And I wouldn't be surprised if it influenced a certain incomparable author in his Galactic Cold War series.
Well, I was thinking of another incomparable author in his Coldest City.
Certainly. Well, my first pick, I'm going to go with something that covers both spies and con artists. I'm going to go with Mission Impossible, but the TV version. Because it's a very different beast from the movies. The movies are terrific, especially now that Chris McQuarrie is writing and directing all of them. But the TV series is a very different beast. It is much more like a con artist game. Usually they have to convince someone to incriminate themselves or convince them to give up the ghost on something, whether it's a device or a MacGuffin of whatever. And they use their face masks. They use gadgetry. They use acting and improvisation. It's not like this running from country to country and performing ridiculous stunts like Tom Cruise. So that's why I say, the film versions are still out there on the board if you would like to pick them. But yeah, Mission Impossible, again, an amazing theme song, a song that has been an earworm pretty much all my life. And I was born when it was still on the air. So, anyway, let's circle back around. Now let's do a round of films if we can. Tom, what would be your first film pick?
My first film pick is going to break from my theme song problem because I don't recall the theme song to Charlie Wilson's War. But I think I might be one of like four people on the planet who really wished they had Charlie Wilson's War on DVD. Philip Seymour Hoffman is unbelievable in it. And I think it's worth a rewatch just for that, just for him alone. And he's the spy in question. Tom Hanks is Tom Hanksing all over the place, and it's a Aaron Sorkin joint. So, you know, cocaine, but
so much walking, so much talking.
And he quotes from himself incessantly. My favorite part was I saw it in the theater because that's who I am. And there is a West Wing episode called The Indians in the Lobby. And in Charlie Wilson's War, Charlie Wilson is leaving his office, and in the lobby are a number of Native American people waiting for him. And I was like, oh, it's Indians in the Lobby. And my date at the time was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, okay, so you got to understand. Well, okay, I'm going to have to tell you when this is over. And I don't think we dated very long after that, but I don't know if those two things are related or not. But as a spies in a spy in the CIA, like the internal machinations of the CIA kind of movie, it does the job. And it's a unflattering section of American spycraft as we decide that we're going to arm the Mujahideen, which went fine forever and then nothing happened. So as a piece of actual history, I think it's pretty successful as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book, and it is a true story.
Yeah. The book is really good as well.
Yes. And it's also Mike Nicholsing up the place.
That's right. He is Mike Nicholsing all over that.
But yeah, no, I highly recommend Charlie Wilson's War. Chris, what is your next film pick, or first film pick, I should say?
Well, these are con artists. Sorry, they're not spies. They're even less spies than John Steed and Emma Peel are. They are Eddie Hawkins and Tommy Fivetone Messina, who's, you know, many, many extended adventures and multi-format franchise, extended universe, continuing saga, et cetera, began with Hudson Hawk in 1991. Such a smash sensation that you know, you just couldn't keep it down. I love this movie. I unironically love this movie. It's not I truly am baffled by how this thing has such a reputation as such a train wreck. I mean, it's certainly, you know, Bruce Willis at the moment in his career when no one could tell him no, but he's surrounded by, you know, you got the director of Heathers coming off of directly off of that film. Tons of character actors in this flick who I like. David Caruso in a silent role, which you know, I think he's pretty great in. Our villains are Sandra Bernhard and Richard E. Grant. We have a character who plays the less talented, less successful brother of a very famous gangster. Cast in that part is one Frank Stallone. James Coburn is basically doing his our man Flint role again in this movie. The plot concerns a cat burglar who's just been released in prison, who is immediately blackmailed by his crooked parole officer into committing some heists for him. And it, you know, turns out they need to steal a bunch of famous art objects in which Leonardo da Vinci has hidden the disassembled components of his alchemy machine. I think the reason I love it, though, is that Hawk and Tommy, played by Danny Aiello, they time their burglaries by singing. You know, you could just look at a watch or something. You know, they know what the police response time is. They know how much time they're likely to have in a burglary site before they're going to be interrupted. And in this universe, the only way they can possibly keep track of time is to choose a song of the appropriate length and then sing it separately while they're committing their jobs. And I love that. I don't know why this movie is so loathed. really, it's so strange, but it never drags. It is a fleet 95 minutes long. And love it. So it's really, you know, my abiding affection, my unapologetic, unironic, and endless love for Hudson Hawk that has me shoehorning it in here by picking the at burglar duo of Eddie the Hawk Hawkins and Tommy Five Tone Messina as a pair of thieves slash con artists. David,
it takes a sleeve. Mm-hmm. I saw it opening weekend. And that's a great pick because they are con artists, but the film itself feels like it's a spoof of a Bond film. I mean, the villains are totally Bond villains. They're rich. They're looking for an insane device. They want to rule the world. This thing jumps from New York to Italy and the Vatican. I mean... It's
but all on location, right? I mean, that's part of why this film was such a financial disaster because they spared no expense.
and I love that it's narrated by William Conrad as if it's a Rocky and Bullwinkle. Oh, yeah. You know, that is just such a random detail. As soon as it came out on Blu-ray, I got the Blu-ray. So, you know,
you bought the other one.
So yeah, no, Hudson Hawk, great pick. Nathan, what is your first film pick?
My first film pick is a film that I actually just recently saw for the first time after snapping it up on sale on iTunes since I saw it in the theater in 2011 when it came out. And that is, I'm picking Hannah Heller from Joe Wright's 2011 film Hannah, which is basically the elevator pitch is, what if Little Red Riding Hood was the Bourne Identity? It is a fairy tale told as a spy thriller about a very strange and talented, shall we say, young woman who's been raised by her gruff woodsman father in the remote Arctic wilderness until the day he gives her a magic box that grants her wish to become a real girl by being abducted by the U.S. military pursued across Europe by a terrifying Kate Blanchett and her preoccupation with her own dental health. My, what big teeth you have. it is a weird, beautiful movie, shot very stylishly and very excitingly, but always with an eye for beauty, even in the action scenes. Saoirse Ronan gives a tremendous performance, both physically. I mean, she's whomping on guys twice her size, but also as this person who's been tremendously sheltered her whole life, has some, shall we say, natural disadvantages toward fitting in with the rest of humanity, but is still very much curious and yearning to be a whole person rather than just a target. And I mean, obviously, you know, Kate Blanchett shows up for anything. She'll take a paycheck. So, you know, when she shows up, it's not a mark of quality. No, I'm kidding. She's fantastic in this movie. There is a scene where she, just a split second scene where she slowly smiles and your blood freezes in your veins. And there's an amazing one-er shot where Eric Bana walks off a bus in Germany through the bus station down into the metro, is attacked by four guys, makes short work of them, and walks off all in a single continuous shot. There's a killer score by the Chemical Brothers that is trippy as all get out. And you get to see to watch Saoirse Ronan break Michelle Dockery's neck, which is something you'll never see on Downton Abbey. So cannot recommend, if you haven't seen it, I can't recommend highly enough Hannah, the weird, dark, utterly pitiless, totally beautiful Joe Wright stab at a spy thriller by way of fairy tales.
Yeah, it is. It's a tremendous film. And you're right. It is beautiful to look at. Gosh, my first film pick, I think I have to go for my favorite con artist pick, my favorite heist pick, the George Clooney Ocean's 11. which probably will not shock regular listeners. And I like the sequels too, but the original I could watch over and over again. It is so meticulously plotted and it's just smart. And coolness is not something that I really worry about or look for in a film, but this is a film that is effortlessly cool. One of my favorite line readings of all is George Clooney just saying, "You think we need 11? You think we need 11? All right, we'll get 11. And the whole time Brad Pitt is just staring. It's one of the simplest little scenes, and yet I just love it. But the other reason I love it is, in modern times, it's really hard to come up with a good heist because of technology. You know, they came up with a really high tech heist that worked. So that's pretty good.
Dude, Ian Brad Pitt don't sing though. They don't sing.
No.
Hard to like time out the robbery. So you got to talk. I don't remember exactly how this happened, but I got to go to an advanced screening of that film in 2001 at the Bruin in Westwood, which, by the way, is the movie theater that Margot Robbie goes to in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood the Matt Helm movie that she's in. It's that theater. And they had an advanced screening of Ocean's 11. This is like way before I was a critic or anything. I don't remember how I ended up there, but I remember they gave away popcorn, which I have never had happen at an advanced screening that I've been invited to in a professional capacity. And then at the beginning, when Clooney sits down in front of the parole board and it's just that close up of his face, he just sits right after the Warner Brothers shield logo and people applauded. Like they just applauded Clooney's face dropping it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So, all right, let's cycle back around to Tom. What is your next TV pick?
Okay, this is absolutely a nostalgia pick, but it is also a banger of a theme song. Scarecrow and Mrs. King, ladies and gentlemen.
Ooh, yes. Talk about an earworm.
I know. It is, one year it was on my Spotify, like, top 100, just because it kept coming up for some reason. Like, they tell you the songs that you've listened to too much. I was like, The Scarecrow and Mrs. King theme, what was I doing? But it hit right in that spot where, you know, you'd sit down with your family to watch TV, and it's easy for everybody to watch it. It was, I'm 85% sure it came on after Star Trek The Next Generation on Channel 50 in Chicago, but I'm not 100% sure. It just feels that way. Put a little Bruce Boxleitner action for you if you're pre-Babylon 5 time. And it's just, it's also a lot of fun. I think that's what we're kind of getting at with all these picks, is that the best spy movies are the ones that don't really take themselves super duper duper seriously and are more interested in like messing around with the genre or messing around with your expectations. And actually, I think that's what the Mission Impossible films do pretty well too. It is mostly action and like bombast, but it's also like quintuple crosses that you're like, this doesn't make any sense. This is too much of a Swiss watch to make any sense, but I'm really enjoying it. Like, how many times can you double cross the bad guy? And I don't remember a ton of towards the end. I was actually refreshing my memory when I was before this, because I knew I wanted to go with Scarecrow and Mrs. King. And I realized that I don't remember like the series. They got married at the end and they kept, and the blurb on Wikipedia was, and they kept it a secret from the agency to, and I was like, I don't remember any of that. I remember that they were like flirty, and I remember that they like dated kind of, And I vaguely remember that they got married, but it's like, it then continued on for some time. Like there were more seasons or at least more episodes. So I don't have a really specific memory of, like, I can't quote you chapter and verse from The Scarecrow and Mrs. Kingopedia, but it's a pick that reminds you of your childhood, you know? So sure. That's where I'm coming from.
It was lighthearted, but fun.
Yeah, it was a riot.
And it was in that stretch in the 80s where, you know, maybe it started with Remington Steele, where you just had this whole will they, won't they tension that wasn't, you know, it wasn't the centerpiece of the show until Moonlighting kind of forced the issue. But yeah, you had a lot of these pairings where it was just this sort of leitmotif in the background, and they had fun adventures and good quips. And yeah, that was a great theme song. That song is in my head to this day. So, okay. On that note, Chris, what is your next TV pick?
Well, I love my lost causes, and here's one that I did not discover in its time. I actually discovered it very recently when it's probably gone now because nothing sticks around on streaming, but this was on Netflix very briefly, a beloved network TV series that ran from 1980 to 1980, starring Tony Award winner Ben Vereen and Jeff Goldblum. You know, not sure if he ever did anything after this, but 10 Speed and Brown Shoe was the name of this show, with Goldblum as a accountant, I think, who wanted to be a hard-boiled detective and was doing this you know, kind of Raymond Chandler parody narration over most episodes. And Vereen as like he was an ex-con who was, you know, kind of doing like the kind of shtick that Eddie Murphy is doing in Beverly Hills Cop, where every time he needs to talk his way into a fancy place, he, you know, quickly creates a character. And this show lasted 14 episodes. This show did not even have the legs that The Prisoner had. But what else can I say to persuade you to locate this if in the unlikely event that it remains on Netflix? The little stinger, the little punctuation is a bike bell sound. You know, and the bicycle is not even like as key a motif the way it is in The Prisoner, the way the penny farthing bicycle is, you know, part of the visual iconography of The Prisoner and has this whole symbolic resonance with it, like as the symbol of progress, and is progress advancing too quickly? And, you know, should we be reconsidering all this surveillance state stuff that was, you know, in the late 60s seemed very, very topical and now seems very, very quaint. But that's not The Prisoner. That's not 10 Speed and Brown Shoe, in which I really can't tell you the significance of the bicycle other than, you know, we need to have two nicknames. We need to have two words. I was thrilled to discover this. I hope it's still available.
It is available in the Shout Factory app. Because that's where I found it by accident one day on my Apple TV, and I went, I remember when that aired, because I loved it. It's not only that, it was created by Stephen Cannell, coming off of the Rockford Files, and, you know, before his whole run of the A-Team and Riptide and all that stuff. So this is Cannell having fun. And yeah, it's a delightful show. So yeah, find the Shout Factory app, and it's free. It's free in the Shout Factory app. Nathan, what is your next TV pick?
So my next TV pick is kind of interesting, because when it was good, it was astonishingly good. And when it jumped the shark, it jumped that shark into the stratosphere. And there was only one element of it that never jumped the shark, which I'll get to. But I'm talking about J.J. Abrams' Alias, which... Now, nowadays, when you think Alias, you think baby Jennifer Garner in a bright red wig kicking people in the head. And yes, that is the strong component of it. But go back and watch just the pilot. It is, you think Lost had a good pilot. Alias grabs you by the throat from second one and does not let go. Alias's whole first season slaps so hard. I mean, we were talking about a network series that had the chutzpah to, for at least the first 13 of its 22 episodes, end every single episode on a cliffhanger, so that you were dying for the next week to see what would happen next. Like 20 something Jennifer Garner doing most of her own stunts, action scenes done on a TV budget that looked and felt like the movies, and just absolutely more heart and more hustle and more style than anything on the air. You had Michael Giacchino, who, you know, it's a TV show, so they can't write brand new music every week. But what Michael Giacchino would do is take the same themes and then reorchestrate them in the style of the various countries that the characters were visiting for their various missions. You had a spy show that had like a weird MacGuffin-y plot involving like ahead of their time future inventions from a guy from the Renaissance. You had a J.J. Abrams love of weird red balls that float. And you had my favorite part of the series, the one part that never jumped the shark, even when, boy, in those later seasons, did it ever jump the shark. Jack Bristow, the main character's dad, played by Victor Garber. Now, most people know Victor Garber as like the lovable, gentle, kind-hearted soul famous on Broadway. But when I met Victor Garber, I didn't know any of those things. I was completely unfamiliar with his career on Broadway. So I met Victor Garber as a stone-cold, flinty badass. Jack Bristow is, I can count on one hand the number of times on the show where he cracks a smile. There's a great scene in one of the later episodes where he is assembling a crib as if it is a military operation. At one point, he has to take a guy's eye out with a spork. And just the way he says spork, dripping with contempt, will never leave you once you've heard it. But Jack Bristow is one of the most phenomenal badasses ever to grace television. He makes Jack Bauer, another Jack B operating on television at the time, look like a cringing wuss. This is a guy who at the end caps off his run on the series by being shot multiple times, getting back up, strapping on a bandolier full of explosives and blowing himself up to give the middle finger to his arch nemesis. I mean, Victor Garber is phenomenal. He is the one bright spot throughout all five decreasingly good seasons of Alias. But if you watch it, go back and watch those, especially the first season. The first two seasons really are pretty killer stuff. After that, you can safely like pretend that nothing else ever happened and write whatever ending you want. But if you do stick with it, which I do not recommend, you will find yourself clinging to Victor Garber like the life preserver that he is. And I love it because now I've seen a lot of other Victor Garber stuff and I know that he's playing against type, but he's playing against type magnificently. So Alias, phenomenal show, at least for its first two seasons, terrible show for its last three.
Nathan, you just called Victor Garber a life preserver. I have to ask you if you did not see Titanic, which was
before. Say,
oh my God.
Titanic is canonically Alias.
There's a sequence in the first season, and it's just, I think it's in like the opening 10 minutes of the show where the characters are trying to do open heart surgery on a guy in an ambulance to remove a bomb from his chest while in the middle of a car chase. It is the most preposterously thrilling thing you've ever seen on television. And it's just a it's like it's Tuesday for that show.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not out of the ordinary at all.
Well, the story is that like Cruz, you know, binged those first couple seasons and then hired him away to make Mission Impossible 3, right? Which I think basically has that sequence that you just cited in it reprised in a helicopter where they're trying to take a like an explosive chip out of someone's brain through their nostril or something while the helicopter is, you know, maneuvering. And, you know, so if it's worth doing once, it's worth doing twice, I guess.
So my next TV pick, I think I'm going to go with a series also on Netflix. I hope it's still on Netflix. Lupin, which is French, based on the books, the original Arsène Lupin books. Or I should say inspired by, because it is set in the present with a Senegalese Frenchman who loves the Arsène Lupin books. Lupin was a cat burglar. He was a character roughly at the same time as Sherlock Holmes. And occasionally his author would steal Sherlock Holmes to stick into stories to have them face off. And Lupin would always get the better of him until Arthur Conan Doyle said, hey, you can't do that. So then all of them are changed to Herlock Sholmes. It's a thing. Copyright theft in the early 1900s. Yay. But yeah, he's a brilliant cat burglar. And so this character is inspired by him, and he finds himself falling into a larger mystery and conspiracy and revenge plot. And his beloved son is kidnapped at a festival celebrating the character of Arsène Lupin in the town in which the author lived. It is a beautiful cliffhanger. I think it is only about 10 episodes long, but it's, again, it's very clever in how it designs its heists and how it builds its plot line. But I would say, don't listen to the dub, use the subtitles, because the voices very much do not match. There, it's not a good dub at all, but the subtitling is good. And you can hear, if you even know just a smattering of French, you can hear how the actors are, well, I mean, they're acting through the dialogue, and that's part of why the dub sucks. But the show is brilliant.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, let's cycle back around one more time for another round of films with Tom.
We're going to discuss the unexpected comedy chops of one Mr. Jason Statham, and what counts as remarkable restraint on the part of Paul Feig. And let's talk about Spy from 2015. The Melissa McCarthy movie that is both as funny as the Get Smart film should have been and as well-crafted as a comedy spy movie should not be. The run of Melissa McCarthy movies in that period, because that's it's Spy as well as Bridesmaids, as well as the Ghostbusters.
And The Heat.
And The Heat, thank you. That was one I was thinking of. Are just remarkable. Like, she has such shocking charisma that you forget about every time until you see the next movie that she's in, because every higher status character. Jason Statham is who I'm thinking of in this one, though Allison Janney in as her boss is spectacular as well. She modulates her status so well with all of those people who are so much more serious than her, that when she pulls the rug out from under them by being competent at her job or whatever, it's just it was delightful from beginning to end. And again, I'm going to harp on the sort of like silly whimsy time, but it's a decent spy plot. It's no stupider than a Bond plot.
I mean, I remember this recurring joke where Statham makes these elaborate, very specific, weird threats or boasts about
yes.
what he has done or will do. And it, like, has anyone ever checked this and seen, like, if Statham over the course of his career has actually done all of these bizarre, specific things that he describes?
I mean, he made Crank and Crank 2, so there's a pretty good chance that those are on the checklist.
The last thing I was going to mention about Spy is that for about 3-4 years, they kept talking about how they were going to make it into a series. And I can't decide if it's the best thing that happened to that movie, that it didn't become like a going concern, or the worst thing that we did get more of them. I'm inclined to be happy that it sort of lives on its own rather than the further adventures of Melissa McCarthy. Yeah. Because I think it really had a nice sort of one evening sort of thing. On the other hand, I'd watch basically every actor that was in that movie just hang out as often as I could.
Sure.
I mean, after Jason Statham saying things like, you know, I once drove a car while on fire, not the car, I was on fire. My second favorite part of that movie is the fact that Rose Byrne's character, her villain character, is actually a character and is actually a person and kind of the sad and lonely and kind of messed up person who, you know, has
and
this
super
weird,
mean.
Super mean, but has this kind of weird empathetic friendship for frenemyship with Melissa McCarthy that really gives the movie a kind of a depth and a heft that I liked.
And we left out Jude Law as well. We just haven't mentioned him.
Right.
as the Bond stand-in who's like really pretty but not good at his job necessarily. Like, he's just kind of a doofus.
And I mean, the number of Bond movies where you actually see Bond get to be clever and figure things out is absolutely dwarfed by the number where he just bumps into obvious clues or, you know, people offer them to him. And so I think that is a well taken point. There's not a lot of evidence in the movies anyway about Bond being particularly an all-star at his job.
So, all right. Spy. Excellent choice. Chris, what is your next film pick?
Well, you know, one guy whose Byzantine plots really do make sense, really do hold together if you care to follow them along is Shane Black. And I'm never going to get the Nice Guys sequel that I pine for. But if I think of, you know, all of the Shane Black Christmas set buddy detective movies as being sort of sequels to one another, then I can, you know, create a through line from Lethal Weapon to The Last Boy Scout to The Long Kiss Goodnight to The Nice Guys, which is the one I like the best from 2016. Another movie that was successful ish, you know, but not as it should have been. Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe have great chemistry together, whereas, you know, Gosling is a ex-cop turned private detective in sleazy 1977 Los Angeles. And Russell Crowe is like an aspiring, he's not even an aspiring cop. He's an aspiring PI. He's a real thug who, as the movie opens, is beating people up for money, but wants to be better, wants to better himself. And Gosling is the, you know, the typical fallen man, that Shane Black likes to people his detective movies with, widowers or drunks or, you know, people who have fallen a long way. All of this is woven into a plot about the auto industry, about Detroit to keep down the catalytic converter or something. And the evidence that they're doing this is hidden in a porn film. Again, it's 1977. So we get a little bit of that Boogie Nights aspect of when illicit stuff had to be filmed on celluloid and projected on screens and could not be consumed in the privacy of your home. And Angouri Rice. This is the first place I saw Angouri Rice, the great Australian actor who plays Ryan Gosling's daughter, who basically keeps him semi-functional. I mean, he is a high-functioning alcoholic in this film. I think her character is supposed to be 12 years old, but she drives him around, chauffeurs him because that's safer than letting him drive a car. There are so many. I mean, as with every Black movie, this is highly quotable. The exchanges of dialogue are great, but there's also a really wonderful moment of physical comedy in this. One of many showcases for how great Gosling is at that sort of thing, where Russell Crowe tracks him down in a men's room and is trying to sort of intimidate him in a bathroom stall and knocks the door down. And Gosling is there trying to point a gun at Russell Crowe, but you know, also trying to pull his pants up and also trying to deal with the cigarette that's dangling out of his lip. I just, you know, see The Nice Guys. Come on. This is, yeah. They're a great duo. I would happily watch another movie about these two clowns every 2 years until the end of my natural life. And I'll never get to, because, you know, we're never letting Shane Black, back, I guess. You know, people are still mad that he got $4 million for the screenplay of The Long Kiss Goodnight or something.
And I agree. I would love at least another story with those Nice Guys.
Yep. you don't think comedy and Russell Crowe together in the same sentence, but he can be tremendously funny, and he is in this movie in a wonderful way.
Okay, let's go to Nathan. What is your next film pick?
Well, speaking of mismatched duos, I think there's a film out there that does not get as much love as it deserves. And part of that is probably because both of its leading men have since been outed as varying degrees of unpleasant, shall we say? But Guy Ritchie's The Man from U.N.C.L.E., I had never seen the original television series, but that is a darn entertaining movie. You think of Guy Ritchie as like he has this reputation as a director who's all flash and no substance, but he doesn't deserve it. And especially in this movie, there's all this amazing stylish camera work, but it is always in clear service of the narrative. There's an incredible sequence where Henry Cavill's Napoleon Solo, suave, dapper man about town, is climbing into a car and casually searching for the keys. He's like rummaging through the car to find that someone has packed a lunch and he's enjoying the lunch. And reflected in the windshield of the car is Armie Hammer. Yes, he's the guy who apparently wishes he could eat people. Moving on. But he's the burly, two-fisted Ilya Kuryakin. And he is having a speedboat chase with lots of explosions that you can follow entirely by watching its reflection in the windshield of the car that Henry Cavill is in. Just one of many incredibly brilliant shots in this movie. And the movie's cleverness even extends to its awesome theme by, yes, Daniel Pemberton, who emphasizes the differences between the two characters by having the score basically be a fist fight between Lalo Schifrin and Ennio Morricone. It's fantastic, really entertaining to listen to. The scene in which a pajama-clad Alicia Vikander is dancing out of focus in the background while Armie Hammer broods in the foreground is an all-timer. And it is just a delightful and fun and entertaining film with a killer cast, possibly literally in Armie Hammer's case.
There's a drive-in in Easton, Maryland, and it is a long way for me here in DC, but it is worth it because you get in the summertime, if your ass can take it, you can see three movies for one admission price. And in the summer of 2015, they had an all-nighter, and it was Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, Spy, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, wow. Those
three nice. In one night, and yeah. Amazing.
Even just the sequence of the car chase and the escape from East Berlin, and it is so cleverly designed and cleverly shot, and it's just fun.
As someone who is famously obsessed with how large Henry Cavill actually is or is not, the fact that in that opening sequence the Berlin sequence when Armie Hammer is chasing them on foot and they're in the car and they're all these remarks to the effect of how large Armie Hammer is and what a beast he is and stuff like is he that much bigger than Henry Cavill? I need to.
I think The Rock bigger than Henry Cavill?
That sequence, Nathan, that you cited, that great sequence where Henry Cavill is just taking the snack break while the boat chase is happening around him, they rip that off at the opening of the second Guardians of the Galaxy, where there's an action scene happening all around Groot, and the camera just stays on Groot while Groot is dancing, and everybody cited it there, and that made me mad because I thought Man from U.N.C.L.E. did it better and certainly did it a couple years earlier.
Yeah. Another good thing about Man from U.N.C.L.E., Elizabeth Debicki is in it, as she is in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. But whenever Elizabeth Debicki shows up, pay attention because she's great. And probably the movie that she is in is going to be better than you are expecting.
Well, speaking of films with problematic leads that I just have to sort of shut my mind off and go, I'm watching a movie. There are some artists that I can't quite separate from. This one I haven't tried to watch since, but Mel Gibson in Maverick, which is another film I was not expecting a lot of because fan of the TV show. How are you going to top James Garner? Well, you cast James Garner in the movie, and it is a delightful film with a script by William Goldman, and it is a classic con artist character from the Old West, Brett Maverick. One of the smartest things they did when they were marketing it, they're like, well, Mel Gibson is Brett Maverick and James Garner is Sheriff so-and-so. And you assume, oh, okay, they're going to be going up against each other. That makes sense. And part of the surprise of it is how they are connected. And I won't say how, but it is a worthy successor to the TV series. It is a fun movie. It has stupidly wonderful Easter egg gags in it. And it was, you know, again, it was at the height of Mel Gibson as fun leading man. And this is a fun movie. So, you know, if you could ignore the real world for 2 hours, it is worth a look. But yeah, both Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Maverick did a really good job catching the spirit and the flavor of it and doing it well.
And yet another actor not known for comedy who crushes it, Jodie Foster, is really, really funny in that movie.
Yes. Yes. And gives as good as she gets.
Right. I need to see that again. So I definitely saw it in the theater. And mm-hmm. I remember it was one of the many Gibson Dick Donner collaborations, but I just don't remember it. You know, it's been almost 30 years.
Yeah. And if you get a chance to see the original TV series, which is hard to find now, you know, everything you know about James Garner, it's there. You know, he's a lovable rogue. He's charming. He doesn't want to fight. But he usually gets the better of everyone. So a lot of fun, a lot of fun. Well, let's circle back now and just do one quick round of something from any medium you want. TV, film, book, comic book, podcast, radio show. Tom, what would be your first pick? I mean, this can also be a bring out your dead round.
Yeah, can I just steal a bunch of stuff? Because
yeah,
the con artist one is was going to be the underrated Psych. I always really enjoyed Psych, as okay. well. And as for another, if you've seen Slow Horses on Apple TV, that's yes. really good, and it feels a lot like in America it was called MI5 because in Britain it was called Spooks, mm-hmm. and that's on the list.
Yep.
Yeah, MI5 is great. It's one of those shows where
it's really good.
Yeah, they don't have the budget to show an explosion. They can only imply it.
The reason that I was talking about this as sort of an embarrassment of riches when we started this is because I'm just looking at things that I thought of. I mean, we didn't talk about Get Smart. We didn't talk about Andor. We could have. We didn't talk about The Americans or Chuck, though I don't know why we necessarily would have. Or
Chuck is not bad. Chuck has its moments.
Yeah. It speaking of has its moments, Homeland is occasionally pretty good as a spy story. Occasionally, it's not as good as a spy story. The Jack Ryan series is a great series of movies. Hunt for October, Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger. The Sum of All Fears is also a movie.
My favorite Jack Ryan is Tilda Swinton.
I think you mean Kate Blanchett.
Damn it.
Again.
The Sum of All Tildas.
All right. I will stop because I just started naming things.
Yeah, Slow Horses is amazing.
Slow Horses is really good. And they just, the second season just started.
I think the second season might be even better than the first.
It just wrapped up, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one that my 18-year-old was curious about. I wasn't planning to watch it, and he got me into it, and we ate it up.
You can't let him discover that sort of thing outside the house.
I know, right?
It's better for him to experience it at home.
So, all right, Chris, what would be your bring out the dead? What have we not mentioned that you want to bring up?
You know what? I always said Randall Flagg, but that's the villain in The Stand, right? No, I want to.
Yes.
In the comic book character.
Reuben Flagg.
Yes, thank you. From Howard Chaykin's American Flag with two G's. Another thing, this was a comic started in, I think, 83. And like Alias, it burned, you know, brightly but briefly and kind of declined before it eventually ended. But there were at least two solid years of Howard Chaykin writing and drawing this kind of dystopian comedy in the vein of like Brazil, although Brazil actually followed this by a couple of years. If I'm thinking about this, set in, I think, 2032 Chicago, after a series of ecological and political meltdowns have left the United States kind of a husk of a country. And
well, that's just ridiculous.
I know, I know. Much of the leadership of the nation, I think, has relocated to Mars. I guess Ruben Flagg kind of counts as a con artist in a way, because he was an actor, possibly an actor in adult films. I may be inventing that detail, but who was replaced by a digital replica, a sim, and needed to find work, and ended up being a Plexus Ranger, sort of like the Marshal, I guess, for the territory of Chicago in the hellacious 2030s. All right, so it's kind of a cheat, but because this is one of the few comic book properties from that super fertile 80s period, just before Dark Knight and Watchmen and Maus and all of that has not been translated to another medium. I'll pick Randall Flagg. Nope, Ruben Flagg. From American Flagg with two G's by Howard Chaykin, which I think is back in print now. Every time someone republishes this, I buy another edition of this, and the most recent one is not that old. So you can probably find it. You know, I hate to actually endorse something that listeners can easily lay their hands on if they want to. But I'm going to American Flagg, two G's.
Great pick. Great pick. Nathan, what is left on your plate?
Well, for the Bring Out Your Deads, I've got Leverage. Talk about another show that unfortunately has unfortunate individuals cast within it, but a deeply satisfying show in which con artists take down the ultra rich, and a shocking number of those ultra rich people are based on real people and real research that the more you look into it, the more frightening the show gets. But super fun. There was a recent revival that was kind of a little bit of diminishing returns, but still captured a little of the old magic. The Spy Who Dumped Me. The best performances you will ever see out of the best performance you'll ever see out of Mila Kunis. A typically wonderful performance by Kate McKinnon. Some really dynamite action, because the second unit director is an experienced stunt coordinator and action helmer, and just a really, really fun, unexpectedly funny and really exciting movie that kind of flew under the radar. But for my final pick, I'm going to go a little highbrow here. I'm going to pick The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton. It is a spy novel unlike any you will ever read, and I cannot spoil why, but you've got to read it. I will say that it is a kinder spy novel than you were expecting, and I can't give away anything more than that, but it is the story of a Scotland Yard policeman sent undercover to crack a ring of anarchists. And it starts like a cold-blooded thriller and gets stranger and funnier as it goes along, until it actually loops all the way around and becomes kind of transcendently beautiful. It's available in the public domain. You can probably find it like on LibriVox if you want to listen to it in audiobook form, or on Project Gutenberg. But it is a really weird, interesting, beautiful novel that takes the spy genre and runs off in a really weird direction with it. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
There's a lovely adaptation of it for the stage, actually, by a Chicago playwright named Bilal Dardai. And it is a tremendous piece of work.
Yeah. I was literally going to say there is a lovely stage adaptation.
I got there first.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stand up for the Orson Welles Mercury Theater on the Air version then, which is the one.
Yeah, good
call. It's 57 minutes long. So,
I don't know Orson Welles personally.
But I haven't read the novel. I've only listened to the, I assume, heavily abridged, 1 hour radio play. So I need to correct that oversight.
Yeah, well worth a read. Yeah, my list is, I kind of wrote down everything I could think of just in case, because it's a draft. I'm surprised The Prisoner didn't show up, but that's okay. He's free. He's gone. And Danger Man and Secret Agent, you know. But they're there. They're there. Again, speaking of problematic leads, I Spy, which was a lovely show in the 60s.
Starring Bill Culp and someone else.
Nobody else.
Yeah.
One-man show.
Just one-man show. Burn Notice, something that kind of surprised me when it premiered because I wasn't expecting much out of USA Network at the time. And this is a show that really captured, it's about a spy, but it was really in that mold of Rockford and Magnum at the same time, which is kind of interesting. Also from USA, White Collar, which con artist turned FBI informant, aide, hero, quote unquote, which, you know, is sort of a modern day riff on It Takes a Thief, also a really good show. And on the con artist side, a TV show, I can't remember if it was the BBC or not, but it's a show called Hustle, starring Adrian Lester and Robert Vaughn and Jamie Murray and several other people whose names escape me now. But it's very much Leverage just before Leverage premiered. It's the same idea. It's thieves targeting people who deserve being targeted. Lovely show. And there's one episode with a terrific Bollywood number, which you would never expect at a spy / con artist show. And I would say, yes, Queen and Country by Greg Rucka, going back to comic books. And like I said, all of the John Dortmunder books by Donald Westlake and the Parker books by Richard Stark, who was Donald Westlake. So on that note, this was a lovely gathering. Thank you all for coming. Tom McGrath, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Chris Klimek, thank you.
David, delighted.
And Nathan, thank you.
Thank you very much. This podcaster will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And so, having once again saved the world with a minimum of spy jinx, we will play the song and roll the credits, but as always, the incomparable will return.